ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
I remember first reading that line and thinking, I'm in.
This book is mad.
You have to be qualified by misery to read that book.
It's an adventure.
She tells a very human story.
It absolutely clobbered me.
I would have liked a bit more plot.
It's unlike any other book I've ever read.
Then you're left absolutely hanging.
Chef's kiss, bellissimo. It's so good. I loved this mystery.
Those words, I could bathe in them.
And as a reader, I want that, I want it all.
All right, this is going to be good, isn't it?
Have you noticed how often there are ravens and magpies in Australian fiction, or black cockatoos that screech and wail, or the raucous laugh of a kookaburra? Hello and welcome to a feathery edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, your weekly review of new books. Although I have to say there are wolves, wild boar and witches in the mix too, not to mention the last year in the life of a famous poet and obsession in Japan. I'm Kate Evans. Cassie McCullough isn't with us this week, although she'll be back next time. Later in the show, critic BJ Silcox will stagger in with a huge pile of books. She's sharpening her pencil and her opinions in the wings. But look who's here right now. Novelist, poet, professor of Australian literature, it's Tony Burch. G'day, Tony. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Kate?
I'm well, thank you. Now, look, we've got a new collection of short stories in front of us from Australian writer Inga Simpson called Once We Were Wildlife. But before we get to that, let's talk about nature writing and eco-fiction, climate fiction. I mean, what term do you like to use, Tony?
Well, I think that cli-fi is the word that's used for sort of climate science fiction writing. I think if thinking about Inga Simpson, I think eco-fiction would be probably the more appropriate term, or I don't know if there's such a term as nature fiction, but she's certainly a writer in this case who's dealing with ecologies, threatened and damaged landscapes and applying a fictional brush to that. So I don't really mind. I think for me the interesting issue, Kate, is that the place of this genre or these types of fiction in Australia at the moment and globally, you may, or some of our listeners may often hear the point that, you know, we should all be thinking and writing about climate change in our fiction. It should be the central issue that we should be concerned about. And I don't agree with that, or I think it's misplaced, but certainly there are a lot of writers who are now working very closely with these issues, and for a very good reason that the planet is under great threat at the moment of damage to ecologies and to the climate.
Yeah, I mean, writers including Margaret Atwood and Lauren Groff, they've argued that all writing now is climate fiction or somehow engaged with climate anxiety. I mean, do you think they're right in making that big claim?
No, I don't actually. Look, there are two ways to look at it. There is one argument, The Great Derangement by Amitav Ghosh.
Yes,
which argued that we should all be writing about climate. In other words, that we should proactively engage with this issue because of the desperation that we're in. That's different than, I'd like to hear, it's probably a bit heavy-handed to say, no, I disagree, because obviously they're both important writers, both really smart writers. So I suppose I should reserve my opinion for listening to how they place that. I think it is the case that, you know, some fiction that is not entirely or centrally engaged with climate does address climate in some way. So even going back to my novel, The White Girl, in 2019, it's not in any way a climate novel, but by the way, there are blackbirds in it. And there is a dry riverbed in that novel that the Aboriginal matriarch Odette walks along. And yeah, from the surface, you would think it was a dead or dying river. But in fact, during that walk, she is nurtured by the spirits in the land that she's on. So that in a way looks at the idea of a damaged landscape under sort of colonization, but the indigenous vitality of that same land. So that is dealing with the issue. I just think that there is, yeah, obviously there's a lot of fiction out there that doesn't address climate even in the most oblique way. And that's just the reality of the world we're in. My point of, I suppose, disagreement, or my point where I would depart from what we should be writing about or what our writing is concerned with, is that I think if we feel that we should include or write about climate and ecological damage or destruction in our fiction, if it doesn't work in, for want of a better term, an organic or, again, this is a loaded word, but in a natural way, I think what we can end up with is producing either quite didactic fiction, fiction by colour by numbers, or just bad writing. And I think it's no different than if someone to say, oh, look, you know, crime fiction's going really well now, Tony, write a crime fiction novel, or this is going well, or that's important. And of course I know how important the issue is, but in my case, I think regardless of important social political issues, if it doesn't feel right, if I can't do it with confidence and some sense of authority, I would write really badly. So I suppose the counter to this is that I'm obviously in my fiction very interested in inequality. I'm very interested in how the marginalised survive in society, how Aboriginal people survive under colonisation. And that is my thing, for want of a more technical term. I would think if you're interested in climate, and I am very much so, I've worked in this area as an academic, is that if you write a novel which is valuing people, valuing community and valuing place in ways that don't directly or indirectly discuss the climate crisis, I think you're still fulfilling an obligation to readers that really are about that people matter, that community matters, that place matters, and therefore what you learn or what you engage with that fiction, I think, would have an impact on how you regard the need to protect the planet.
Well, and I'm interested that you use the word place there, Tony, because like when you talked about what you did in White Girl and in other other things that you've written, I mean, that sense of place is so strong. And with writers like Melissa Lukashenko, Tara June Winch, that sense of place and an engagement with, well, I always think birds because of the brolgas in Tara June Winch's work, or the talking crows in Too Much Lip by Melissa Lukashenko. It's an engagement with place and a deep history of the place without having to use labels, which, as you say, can be in danger of being didactic, which is something that storytellers always have to be quite wary of, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And thinking back as you were talking, thinking back to my second novel, Ghost River, which I wrote in, I think, 2011. Yeah, 2011. I think what's important to remember there in that novel is that there is an engagement between two teenage boys, Sonny and Ren, with a group of homeless men who are, you know, heavy drinking alcoholic men, led by a wonderful Aboriginal man called Tex, or Texas. And Tex tells the boys the story of the deep time history of the Birrarung, the Yarra River. And again, that novel doesn't discuss the current climate crisis in any way. It's set nominally in the early 1970s. But I would imagine that someone reading that book, you know, in contemporary Australia, and reading about how this Aboriginal man is able to talk about the deep value of country, again, I would think that someone interested in you know, climate justice or the climate crisis would get from that book, okay, this is someone telling us a story that we have to understand the vital history of this place and we have to care for this river. So in other words, I think we don't have to be directly engaging with this issue to engage with this issue.
Yeah, and that's something that I think even Ian McEwan has done in his latest novel, What We Can Know, which is set in a flooded future Britain. And so on the one hand, you've got a dystopian landscape, and on the other, it's a novel that deeply engages with the past and archives and poetry and a sort of looking back. And I'm sort of interested in how often people can write what you might think of as climate fiction by writing a dystopia as well, because there's a lot of pretty interesting examples of that around.
Well, I think this is historically the case. You're entirely right. The other issue I think that's relevant to, say, McEwen's work, the other responsibility or thought that I have here in regarding to writing climate, I won't go into detail, but in the research fellowship that I was awarded to deal with climate justice, which was a five-year professorial fellowship, one of the issues of concern was, how do you talk about climate crisis in a way that engages people and doesn't unnecessarily make them feel optimistic, but in a way energizes them to act? And if you were to take, say, a novel like Cormac McCarthy's The Road, I mean, brilliantly written book, but so depressing and so dark that you want to go to bed and hide.
Well, look, you know what, Tony? I know we are heading towards Inga Simpson's collection of short stories, but I wondered if we could just pause for a minute and I can tell you about another book that I've just read, partly because it does the dystopian thing and there's a focus on a child, which I think you might find quite interesting. It's by an Australian writer called Sarah Walker, who's written a collection of essays called The First Time I Thought I Was Dying. But her new novel, it's called The Water Takes, and it's set in an Australian city, well, sort of in a suburbia, really. And there's this woman called Pam who's in her 70s. She lives alone. Her partner's died. She's really sort of sharp and funny and a bit fierce. And she's noticed that her backyard is getting swampy and wet. And there's a girl, a 10-year-old girl who lives next door who she looks after sometimes. And then holes appear in the footpath. There are sinkholes and then entire houses fall in. It becomes almost a version of The Road or a bit like that bit in John Wyndham's Day of the Triffids.
Yep.
When people are having to make their way in the world, find food, travel across a landscape. And it's very Australian and familiar and sort of flooded. And I thought, gee, this is compelling. It's funny. There are also, you know, bleak moments, but not as bleak as The Road. And so I was really drawn into this book and thinking about, you know, climate fiction and what it does. You know how you enter into a book in terms of the rules of that world? And so if they tell you it's a flooded landscape, I believe it's a flooded landscape. Mm. And then something happened right at the end and I thought, oh, maybe I'm reading a different book. Maybe this isn't a literal flooded landscape after all. And everything I thought I'd read turned on its head in a way I can't really give away. But it was such a clever way of doing a story about a flooded land. So that's a new book called The Water Takes that's just come out. But have you got another example that you think does that sort of sense of climate justice or that somehow engages with it in a way that you think is really good?
Well, this might sound really odd. I think that some Aboriginal writers who are dealing with historical fiction that may not seem to have anything to do with the climate crisis actually inform my sense of what's happening in contemporary Australia. And again, this is, seems like a long bow, but Kim Scott, who I've written a short book about, That Dead Man Dance. And just to give the premise here, it's for hopefully to make sense to people. That book is centrally about Aboriginal people in this part of Western Australia deciding that cohabitation and coexistence may be possible and that friendship with settler invaders may be possible. And there are moments when it does become possible and then the whole potential of productive relationships is entirely shattered. And then, of course, we end up in a situation of extreme colonial violence. And why I say that is informative in the sense when I think of the hubris of colonial societies, when I think of the ecological damage done by societies that have no understanding of how country works, when I think about parts of the Western District of Victoria which were really destroyed agriculturally within a generation of European farming. What I think about there is, had settler Australians just listened, observed, and engaged with the knowledge of local Aboriginal nations and communities, the whole way we would conceive of our relationship to place in Australia would be different. And the other point there, Kate, which is relevant about that book and that, I suppose, Kim Scott's philosophy, is that when I did the climate change and climate justice fellowship, I understood that, one, there were short-term crises that we had to deal with immediately, both in Australia and internationally. Yeah, you've got whole nations about to be submerged by rising sea waters. You've got the grave sites of ancestors on the Torres Strait being lost to community. So I understand the immediate crises of extreme weather events. But I finished that fellowship believing if we're really going to tackle climate justice and we're going to reverse these terrible problems, we actually need generational change, philosophical, ethical, intellectual change, which would take a generation to completely shift the way we think about our relationship to nature, to place, to country. And I think a writer like Kim Scott, he has been trying to allude us to the fact that you got these things wrong. Here's the opportunity to read a historical novel and think about how we might get it right.
Oh, Kim Scott, That Dead Man Dance. What an extraordinary book. And thank you for reminding us of it. And I should also say that this is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf with me, Kate Evans, and with guest Tony Birch, whose books include Women and Children, Dark as Last Night, and Pictures of You. Now, it's taken us a long time to get back to the collection of short stories that sort of sparked this conversation, Once We Were Wildlife by Inga Simpson. How would you describe what she's doing in this collection? Because there's sort of a couple of different through lines. I mean, there's 12 short stories.
I mean, several things or several approaches. I think centrally, Inga's a writer who's been committed, I think, her whole writing life to the issues of protecting country and having incredibly valuable and respectful relationships to place and country. What she's doing here, I think the stories that evoke so much excitement for me are the stories when, I suppose, the protagonist, the human characters in the story, not only value place and landscape, but they understand the authority and value of non-human species. And I think the stories that work so effectively for me are those where there's a realization amongst the human characters about their acceptable humility in a place dominated by non-human species. Two of my favorite stories being Blue Crane and Seawolf. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful moment in Blue Crane, which we might think of as a sort of ending of magic realism, and I won't give it away, but where something happens that you sort of, again, grabs your attention, where an older woman decides that she wants to be something she's not. And in Seawolf also, the attraction, the dignity of wolves, and how a woman comes to be feel so attached to the non-human. Those stories in relationship to wildlife or to animals, I think, is one of the keys. The other one is, of course, is the relationship between people and country and the damage done to country. So there are stories, for instance, that look at campaigns by eco-activists who are involved in quite overt sabotage of mining company machinery and mining country activity to protect Aboriginal country. There's a story here which is a tribute to, I suppose, the photography that was produced around the campaign to save the Franklin River.
There's a lot of interest in photography, isn't there? It comes up as a sort of a form of witnessing and documenting, but also, I guess, appreciating beauty.
Yeah, and I think you say documenting, I think that one of the things that people involved in what we might call the environmental movement, in other words, the environmental activist political movement, is in fact for people who don't have access to places of nature and beauty to make sure that we get an insight and an engagement with those, and often that through photography and film. And again, everyone knows that the Franklin River campaign was one of those campaigns that so much visual imagery of the beauty of that landscape was reproduced for people on mainland Australia. In the book, we're talking about a story that looks at, I don't know if people are aware of this, but what we call the flooding of Lake Petta, which is a very unique waterway in Tasmania, which was flooded for a hydroelectric scheme. And over the decades, there have been, well, not attempts, but there's been discussions among scientists and environmentalists to in fact recover that lake, and the suggestion that it could be recovered and returned to a pristine condition. And there are certainly doubts about that. But I think as a sort of a hope or a metaphor for how we might think about saving landscapes or protecting them, it's a wonderful story that deals with that. There are other stories that bring what we might call the everyday domestic experience of, families, relationships, et cetera, where the environment or the natural environment, rather than be a character in those stories, is a characteristic or a setting for the story. So you get variations where I think we might say place, landscape, environment are characters, are central and key characters. And then there are other stories where both the non-human and the environment or the natural environment and place are, yeah, for want of a better term, and I think it's might be a bit simplistic, are backdrops to stories. And I think what Inga Simpson is doing in the book, and I think she does successfully in most of the story, is to, in a sense, get us to accept that landscape place is not a benign force. It is actually pulsating in our lives, and we need to be aware of that.
And that collection of short stories is called Once We Were Wildlife by Inga Simpson, and it's published by Hachette. You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf with me, Kate Evans, and Professor Tony Birch from the University of Melbourne, poet, novelist, short story writer. Tony, for a couple of years, you were one of the judges of the Stella Prize for women and non-binary writers. What's so important about a prize like this?
I mean, there was a bit of debate, of course, about the Stella when it was inaugurated, which I thought was petty. I think it's an absolutely vital award. And to be honest, Kate, whatever I might want to argue for its validity was nothing as important as having read many books over 2 years and just been astounded by the depth of quality of writing, both fiction, nonfiction, and poetry of these writers, and really being surprised, and I suppose, I don't know if I should feel guilty about that, being surprised at how much great work was out there. Now, obviously, I do read many books that would be on the Stella long list, so it wasn't as if I wasn't reading these books. It was that just being, you know, really joyfully surprised about the absolute breadth. So I suppose the thing about the Stella, because you're dealing with different genres, so you're dealing with fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, you really get to engage with writers working across such a broad swathe of interest. So I was just so astounded by and pleased by the quality. And I think it is absolutely vital, an award for the recognition that it gives. It's had such an impact on young writers in particular, certainly had an amazing impact on First Nations writers. And I think that the work done by the Stella Foundation more broadly, so people may or may not know that there's also a lot of work done with schools. There's programs throughout the year. So it's not an award like the Miles Franklin Award, which is really something that sort of happens around a few weeks of the year. The Stella Foundation are doing work right across the year with readers, with schools, etc. Probably flies under the radar a bit, and that's okay because it's working at the community level. So they're working at a level where us who see the award winners or the shortlist get to engage and read those books, but there's a lot of stuff that we don't even hear about that is being done at a local community level, which is equally important.
And also, as you say, as readers, it can give you access to books you might not have read. And there's one on this list that particularly changed my way of thinking as a reader. So I was involved with the announcement of the shortlist recently, and the winner is going to be announced on the 13th of May.
I thought you were just about to announce the winner.
No, that would be very startling for all of us. I have no idea who's won this year, the 2026 Stella Prize. But why don't we just do a quick rundown of the shortlist in alphabetical order. The first, Evelyn Araluen's The Rot, published by UQP. Now, she's a poet. This is a collection of poetry as well as other sort of fragments. What would you say about this collection, Tony?
To be honest, I think Evelyn Araluen is just the major poet working in Australia today. I mean that, I know it sounds a bit sort of over the top, but I really feel that. Drop Bear, her previous book, her first book that won the Stella, was a remarkable collection. I think this collection, it shows incredible intellect, incredible power of language, and then great insight into contemporary and historical life in Australia and contemporary life globally. It is a work of poetry that deals with sometimes very complex issues, particularly dealing, as we are, with the war on Gaza, which is apparent in this book, dealing, of course, with issues of colonial history and the colonial legacy of violence in Australia, But Evan Arulona is also acutely aware of the place of, you know, for want of a better word, of popular culture, of social media, of our unnecessary concerns about how we look and how we feel and the superficiality of that. It is a really strong critique, I think, of Australian culture, but produced in a way that is so original. And I think people who, whether they are coming to poetry as, you know, very literate or for a first time, would be really reading something of great originality.
As we move through these, leap in if you've read any of these as well. Otherwise, I'll just do a fairly brief description. Geraldine Brooks' Memorial Days, that is a memoir of grief, and it's a story of the writer Geraldine Brooks sort of circling around again and again to the day when her husband, the journalist Tony Horvitz, died. And so it's trying to face this terrible moment, but it's also about other forms of grief and loss, in that she returns to Australia, she confronts the sort of grief at the heart of the country, and it's a non-linear story as well, and beautifully, beautifully written. Miranda Darling, her book Fire Weather, follows on from an earlier book around the same character, a character called Winona Dalloway. So, yes, there is a reference to Virginia Woolf in there. And it sort of fits in with our earlier conversation, Tony, about climate fiction, because there's a fire roaring in the background of this story, but it's also about a woman whose mental health is fragmenting, somebody who is escaping a domestic violence, or certainly a situation that is very aggressive. She loves her children. She has these voices in her head that come back to her. It's a very powerful piece of fiction, that
Can
one.
Can I just to comment on that, I think when you talk about the fire in the background, and I think it's a very apt word, the other issue we're seeing, I think, where fiction that is dealing with dramatic weather events, such as bushfires in Australia, it is interesting the extent to which you will get these, you know, background fires or natural weather disasters, often coupled with forms of either domestic violence or certainly domestic aggression. And I don't think that is coincidental. I think as the planet heats up, as we have more violent and dramatic weather events, its ability to impact negatively on our human relationships rather than positively, as we tried to talk about before, is really apparent with some of our contemporary fiction writers.
Yes, and it's that sort of hot breath breathing down our necks as both readers and the characters that just sort of heightens the story, and it does it beautifully in this novel, Fire Weather. Now, the other one that I was interested to talk to you about, Tony, is it's a graphic novel by Lee Lai, and it's called Cannon. It also is full of birds that at times just fill the page and reflect what's happening in the interior world of the character, a young woman known as Cannon. Her name is Lucy, but she's described as a loose cannon, so Cannon's a sort of nickname. But what I loved about this, as somebody who had not read many graphic novels, is that at first I was confronted by how to read it. I had to sort of teach myself how to read something where there's this tension between the images and the story. It didn't take long, and I was just reading it as another work of literary fiction in these sort of queer characters with a sort of Chinese background in Toronto. And this character is dealing with a friend who's a sort of selfish writer and a grandfather who's at the end of his life and a mother who's disappeared. And it's just this wonderful piece of writing that made me go, oh, this is what graphic novels can do. It was an absolute revelation to me.
People in doing creative writing at universities would be aware that, you know, teaching graphic fictions in the graphic novel has become a really important genre in the last decade, maybe even two decades. So at Melbourne University, where I teach, graphic fiction is taught and has been taught for a long time, very popular. You know, it's obviously in a contemporary environment, it's because, yeah, people, I think the visual narrative is really attractive to people who are growing up with more social media. Kate, maybe your problem is you didn't read enough comics as children.
That is obviously a problem. Well, I thought I did.
Well, see, we grew up in a house that only had comics. We didn't have books. So I love graphic fiction. And just as a personal aside, I didn't grow up reading Shakespeare and was very intimidated by Shakespeare. And I remember when I went to university and I think I did Macbeth and Othello, and I couldn't get into it. And someone gave me a graphic version of Othello and I got it straight away. And I was able to go back to the text without the pretty pictures. So I think it also functions in a way that might work more effectively with the way we understand narrative or the way we read stories. So I actually am really attracted to it. And of course, graphic fiction, the artistic work is remarkable.
Yes, and this really is a beautiful, beautiful graphic novel. That's Lee Lai's Canon. The other thing that often comes up here on the bookshelf is books that play around with form and that are sort of hybrid forms. Marika Sosnowski's 58 Facets on Violence and the Law is a book that is a combination of a family history of stories about the Holocaust, stories about Israel, but also a contemporary, a very active contemporary engagement with Syria, with law, with the violence of law, with the question of checkpoints and how they operate as a space in between law and belonging. And it's such an interesting work that is, well, it's nonfiction, but it's also memoir and it's also a sort of legal analysis. And it's all in there in this book. That's called 58 Facets. And then there's one more work of fiction on this Stella shortlist, and that's Tasma Walton's I Am Nanat Garuk, which is a book, Tony, that I found so stressful to read because it begins with a sort of a camp full of Aboriginal women in the 19th century and this beautiful, tender image. And as you read it, you just know that something is going to happen and that these forces are going to come and take at least one of these women, and in fact many of these women children, away.
Yeah, and I know this book well. I know Tasma Walton quite well also. It's a remarkable book, but it's such an important book. Tasma's writing about one of her forebears, a Bunurong woman. I think what's important here is not only the quality of the writing and the importance of the story, but as you allude to, it's also a very tragic story and aspects of it are so sad. But it's so important because some people may not know this history and they should. We should all know this history. And this is the history which is about, the kidnapping, murder, rape, slavery of Aboriginal women, in this case, what we call the Mornington Peninsula in contemporary Victoria, but really important Bunurong country, Aboriginal women who were stolen by sealers, women who were taken to the Bass Strait Islands, particularly the Cape Barren Islands, women who were taken onward to Kangaroo Island in South Australia, and then in the case of this novel and certainly in the case of Tasma Walton's forebear, actually then taken to the other side of the country, to Western Australia. And I think that what people need to recognise that this book alludes to, one, is the incredible authority and communality of Aboriginal women within their own communities and families and their importance as not only mothers but as matriarchs. Two, the violent history of slavery and the enslavement of Aboriginal women, which is not known well enough. And also that the legacy of these histories, so that the migration, the forced migration of Aboriginal people is often not known. So in Tasma Walton's circumstances, she does, write the fact that this is a very important personal novel to her. Here's a woman, in her case, who grew up in Western Australia, whose country is, in fact, in Victoria, or today's Victoria. So the forced migration of Aboriginal women in the 19th and 20th century is a history that we all need to know about. It is such a tender book in the way that we get, I think, insight into the incredible lives of these women and their tenacity and their courage. I was really knocked over by this book, and I hope it's a book that gets a wide readership. I think it's a book, as difficult as it is, or for some people confronting, I think it's a book that needs to be taught as widely as possible also.
I totally agree. I mean, I said it was confronting. It is also utterly engaging. And so they are the six books on the Stella shortlist. The winner will be announced on the 13th of May. Tony, Tony, we've covered a book or two today on the bookshelf.
We certainly have.
But any other recommendations you'd like to throw on our shared book pile?
Yeah, just a really quick one. John Higgs, Lynchian, The Spell of David Lynch, a short book. It's sort of a long essay, possibly. I mean, I'm fascinated by David Lynch, but regardless, I think the insight into a genuine artist and maverick and his very idiosyncratic ways of engaging with the world, which are obviously apparent in a lot of his filmmaking. It's really wonderful book, really well written, and you wouldn't have to know David Lynch to enjoy this book.
Tony, I love the fact that we are getting a sense of your interests outside fiction, outside poetry. So we're learning about your film, your music, your other interests as a non-fiction reader.
Oh, absolutely. And just to give a point to that, I think my fiction is as informed by music and film as it ever will be by literature.
Well, and remember too that we do list all the books discussed on the bookshelf in our show notes. Just search for ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf and it's all there. Tony, thanks so much for joining us to talk books.
Thank you very much.
Tony Burch's books include Shadowboxing, The White Girl and Pictures of You. He also writes a very fine essay. Don't go anywhere though, because critic BJ Silcox is on her way. Now it's time to welcome writer and critic BJ Silcox into the Bookshelf studio. That's quite a pile of books you've brought with you.
Oh, hello, Kate Evans. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, look, we've been talking nature writing, dystopias, climate fiction, comic books and sinkholes so far, but you're going to take us to Japanese fiction in translation and the work of Asako Yuzuki. Now, remind us of who she is and the sort of curious shape of her popularity.
Oh, so she had a really international breakout book, an amazing breakout book, Butter, which I'm sure people will have heard of. It had this fantastic premise, which is a serial killer, or an alleged serial killer, waits in prison, accused of having poisoned a number of lovers with her gourmet cooking, and a young reporter who wants to make a name for herself strikes up a kind of interesting correspondence over recipes and food that sort of morphs into something a little bit more sinister and then something quite strangely wholesome. So it was a really interesting breakout book that was really huge everywhere except Japan. And that was the really interesting part. I got to interview Asako Yuzuki when she came to Melbourne Writers Festival last year, and she was taking photos of the crowd to prove to people back home that she was famous.
So they didn't believe that she was a big name and had a huge readership outside Japan.
No. So unconvinced was her Japanese publisher that Butter would amount to anything that when it sent it off for sort of an overseas bidding war, which is what ended up happening, all they did was run the first chapter through Google Translate. They did not even pay for a translator to sort of, you know, send the book out in its best shape. Obviously, it has since been beautifully translated by the wonderful translator. I think her name is Polly Barton. She's fantastic. But no, the publisher didn't think it would amount to much. When I read it, I was really struck by how nuanced the notion of womanhood and feminism was in the book. But apparently in Japan, it's considered polemical and no one was really that excited by it. So it was a really interesting disconnect to have this author with a rock star welcome in Melbourne who was sort of perplexed by the whole shenanigans.
It's also curious because there's been other Japanese writers whose work have been very popular in translation that also have been interested in being a woman in Japan and a sort of feminist take on it. I mean, I'm thinking of Meiko Kawakami's Breast and Eggs.
Convenience Store Woman, the Sayaka Murata.
And Earthlings, which was another one of hers, which was sort of slightly odd. There's often a sort of an unusual take on the world.
I really
in these
love
books.
Diary of a Void. Have you read that one by Inu Yagi? It's about a woman who is effectively a tea lady inside an office block, and she's sick and tired of being spoken down to by all the men she works with, and she fakes a pregnancy, and then all of a sudden she's treated with such care and compassion, and everyone wants to know what's happening in her life, and everyone around her is so excited for her, and she has to keep this ruse up for the whole 9 months in order to keep getting that sort of social attention. And it's this really funny sort of take on what it means to sort of to be a woman and how we might subvert those expectations. I really love it. That's a great one.
And so there seems to be a lot of writing about food and bodies and, I don't know, rice crackers and beauty mythology and all of that in a whole lot of these books. But let's turn to the latest of Asako Yuzuki's novel to be translated into English. It's called Hooked, but it's not the last one she wrote.
So I believe it's the first one she wrote, that it was written before Butter but has been released after Butter. And so it's interesting to see it as a kind of a first novel, a debut novel. It goes back to really similar territory that you were just talking about, food and bodies and labour and loneliness. And in this case, it's sort of also looking at the ways in which women's friendships form in a very similar way that Butter does. I think the two of them are a really interesting set of companion books. This one is about Eriko and Shoko. So Eriko is a young woman who seems to have it all. She's in her early 30s. She works for a very prestigious Japanese import company. She runs an account all to herself. She's very well put together. She comes from the right family. She comes from the right suburb. She seems to have it all. And yet she is filled with this deep and sort of unquenchable loneliness. And late at night, she reads the blog of a woman called Shoko, and it's a blog about the world's worst wife. And Shoko writes this blog under a pseudonym. Her pseudonym is Hallie B, and it's Hallie B, I'm the world's worst wife. And it is this blog about her sort of rootless, very quiet, rootless life, eating convenience store food, not trying too hard to clean the house, not living up to all of those impossible standards, not folding the towels and putting away the laundry, not, you know, breaking herself on making her husband's dinner, but sort of leaning into being a bit of a couch potato. And Eriko is really captivated by this blog and sort of inveigles a way to meet Shoko. And so the two of them have this one beautiful, perfect night of friendship. And I'm sure plenty of people have had that experience when you meet a new person that you think just might be your best friend. They sit down at dinner together in a little diner and the light is great and they have a wonderful talk and the food is comforting and nothing feels too high stakes and they confide in one another. And when it's time to go home at night, Eriko sits on the back of Shoko's bike and sort of gets driven back to her apartment block like best friends would in high school. And yet they can never recreate that perfect meeting. And that's when things start to go a little bit south.
I'm curious that it's a blog that brings it together, because blogs were hip and happening for a while, but now we've sort of moved on from it. I mean, does that date the book?
Yeah, it certainly does. It certainly does. This is the era of WordPress blogs, when people were getting book deals on the back of showing their life to people. And I suppose that still does happen. It just doesn't happen on blogs. But this was the kind of the early era of tentatively starting to put your life online, your everyday life online. So it does date it, although the book doesn't really engage with that as a sort of time period. It sort of gives it that sense that you're stepping into this insular world.
And I guess if you're stepping into that world and you're then obsessed with this other person's life and world, how does it shift? I mean, there's the potential for obsession and voyeurism and, you know, and what it means to step into somebody else's life.
There certainly is. And the more Eriko sort of falls into Shoko's blog, the more her life starts to unravel in ways that were probably inevitable. You know, the high-powered job is actually a job that her father got her. All of her beauty is coming at a cost. She feels so isolated from everyone around her. She's never had real friendships, and yet this blog feels like a window into companionship, into not being so alone, and into being allowed to let go of all of those impossible standards. And so it feels really intoxicating to have someone see you where you never felt seen before, except that's not how Shoko feels about Eriko. And so as one woman becomes obsessed with the other, Shoko starts to realize she's created something that she can't control that might belong to other people. And then she's being offered the chance to turn it into something. To, you know, maybe it might be a book. Maybe it might be a sort of media empire. And all of a sudden, she's starting to perform for it. So all of the things that it made it so intoxicating to people are starting to disappear as she takes on the veneer of a more perfect lifestyle performer. And the two women are sort of caught in this anti-friendship that swirls around these ideas of what it means to live an authentic life and whether or not it's possible for two women to truly be friends. So there's a wonderful metaphor that runs all the way through the book about the Nile perch, a fish which is an introduced species that eats everything around it.
Again, eating food, consuming the world.
So Eriko is working on importing the Nile perch to Japan as a foodstuff. But it becomes this metaphor for one of the women. But which one is it? Who is the Nile perch? Who is eating everything in front of them? Who is making it impossible for anything else to live? Is it Eriko? Is it Shoko? Who might destroy the other? And what kind of pond has been created that says that two women must compete with one another, that there's no capacity for them to have friendship, there's no capacity for them to have love and care for one another. So it's a really interesting psychological portrait of the sort of stifling expectations of womanhood and how they can turn toxic against other women because they're weaponized by a society that's really much happier when women are pulling themselves to pieces rather than trying to pull the structure itself to pieces.
And so what does this mean for the feel of the book? I mean, does it shift as it goes along? It sounds as though there's potential for this to become quite dark as a sort of, what, psychological thriller?
So it reminded me of those sort of 90s psychological thriller movies like Single White Female, the you know, friends sort of turning on one another, copycats. And it had that homoerotic, sensual edge to it. And my only wish for this book, I think the same as Butter a little bit, is that it went darker. I think Asako Yuzuki has a wonderful, deep, transgressive brain. And this book goes almost to those depths and then, like Butter does, sort of pulls out. Although in this book, it goes for something a lot less resolved and touchy-feely than Butter did. Butter was a lot more about community and self-actualization and cooking the meal that nourishes your soul. This is a lot more unresolved, and I found it the more interesting and more exciting book because it sort of cruelly doesn't have an answer to its big questions.
Ooh, a bit of cruel reading for our bookshelf listeners there, BJ.
Yes, very spiky, but also in typical Yasako Ozuki style, beautiful descriptions of food, sex, decadent, almost indecent descriptions of food.
And the book is called Hooked. It's translated from the Japanese by Polly Barton and it's published by Fourth Estate. Now, here on the bookshelf, let's maybe stay with the question of obsession and women being obsessed with other women, because I want to tell you, BJ, about a book that's set in the 1960s and it sort of swirls around a contemporary icon, I guess. And it's a novel woven around the last year or so in the life of the poet Sylvia Plath, who died by suicide in 1963. Now, before we get to that novel, are you or have you ever been a Plath devotee?
Oh, sounds like some sort of confession. I am interested in the cultural engine that Sylvia Plath is, the kind of grand obsessions and art that she sort of sparks and ignites in other people more than I am interested in the poetry herself. So I'm interested in the Sylvia Plath mythos.
Yes, I am as well. I mean, I know there are so many people who are obsessed with Sylvia Plath's life and her poetry and her marriage to the poet Ted Hughes as well. And there have been so many books and essays and so on written about all of that. But this new book, it's by a writer called Helen Bain, and it's called The Daffodil Days. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that it more swirls around Sylvia Plath than focusing on her. She is sort of a character in this novel, but what it does is it, well, I think she's taken an idea like the Dickinson line, tell all the truth but tell it slant, and taken that as an approach to her writing, which is something that a writer like Colin McCann does as well. And so what Helen Bain has done is start with December 1962 and then work backwards to 1961. And it's full of chapters of other characters who are in the small town in regional Britain where Sylvia Plath spent the last year or so of her life. And so the town is called North Taunton, and so the first chapter, for example, is a woman called Nancy Axworthy closing up the house in which Sylvia Plath had been living. So it's a story about, you know, the house being cleaned and closed up and what it means to live in this small town. There's another that actually one of my favourite chapters, and it's a shop girl who works in a clothes shop that has extraordinary pretensions to being the place where you might go if you want to be well-dressed. And it's about this girl who has all of these ambitions. She wants to, she's a working-class girl, works in this shop, reads fashion magazines, and dreams of going to London. And one afternoon, she has an encounter with this sort of this glamorous figure who steps into her shop and doesn't buy a dress. And so that's what this novel does again and again. It takes on the characters around Sylvia Plath, which I think is actually quite a clever way into it.
It sort of reminds me, listening to you talk about it, of Fiona McFarlane's Highway 13.
Because
that was a linked collection of stories that was, in a sense, pointedly not about, but about Ivan Milat, the serial killer. But he never appears. It's all the people around him who encounter him in different ways, either through grief or through you know, missed opportunities or lives lived in the shadow of what he's done. So this sort of feels the same way, but instead of a serial killer, we have Sylvia. Is that a...
It's actually
sort of the tone, or
yes, it's because Highway 13 had that sort of whole feel of grief and potential violence, as well as all the sort of tangential connections that really thrum through that novel. I mean, like the sound of a distant car on a highway. So the style is completely different in The Daffodil Days, but what it is alike is in circling this this huge cultural moment. And the other thing that Helen Bain does very well is right at the end, her notes are very good and very detailed in exploring how she found these little moments of connection. And it's both it's a textual based, you know, finding these traces. And then it was also research and oral histories and so on.
Oh, so it's got an archival basis to it.
Yes, it does, as well as a spatial one, because it's about this particular town. So there's a sense that there is a huge amount of work and sort of scholarship behind it. But it also raises that question of, you know, did it really need Sylvia Plath to work as a novel?
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Is this about... Also, is it about Sylvia Plath as an idea? Is Sylvia Plath necessary? And is it about her life or her death? Because one of the things that I find unsettling about a lot of this is that we focus on the kind of the grand martyrdom of Sylvia and not the work itself.
Well, and the tragedy of it. I think what she's done in this book is something very clever in doing almost the lead up and almost the work and almost the life. So there's a real, there's a clever restraint to it. I mean, part of me wanted just that shop girl story because she was wonderful. And I know that people who know Sylvia Plath's work and poetry will get extra things out of it, but I think it will work for the fans and the non-fans as well, because it does work as this, it's almost like a series of short stories, but it's not. These chapters in a life. I think it's actually very well done. And that's called The Daffodil Days by Helen Bain, and it's published by Bloomsbury. A reminder that you're listening to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, podcast, broadcast, or on ABC Listen, with me, Kate Evans, and critic and essayist BJ Silcox. And we're so used to giving people book recommendations, you and I, BJ, which is really fun, but let's talk about how you collect new books, how you find things to read. So you've been travelling, BJ. What did that mean for your reading?
It meant, and this is a horrible, horrible confession to make, I have not read a book in a month.
Oh, no.
And it is probably the longest in my entire reading life that I have gone without reading a book. I was taking my wonderful mum for a dream trip around the UK, which may or may not have something to do with a family curse. And we were doing this wonderful trip together, but we were gorging ourselves on life. And we were up at the beginning of the day and we walked until our feet gave way, and then we talked until our brains gave way. And we just didn't get the chance to read. But what I did get the chance to do was bookshop, and I sent home 18 kilos of books.
Oh, that's expensive.
Not as expensive as the books themselves, although much cheaper than Australia, and so many things. It was like, kid in a candy store doesn't even start. I went to so many bookstores, and the wonderful part was I went in and I said to these fantastic booksellers all over the country, what's weird and strange that I haven't read? And I just had the best conversations. I just had the most amazing time. And I have been recommended the weirdest shit. And I'm so excited about it all. I've actually bought a stack of it in, you can hear. Here's my big stack.
So that was your parameter then, or that was your request to these booksellers, give me something strange, something that I haven't heard of. So what happened?
What happened? So, I have a book here about a woman who has an affair with a lobster on the Titanic. I have a book that is written entirely in eulogies for chickens. Eulogies for chickens. I have another book that begins in an explosion in a custard factory, and another one that is written entirely in verse. I have just got the greatest set of things. They're all fantastic. I'm excited to read all of them.
Oh, give me the names of some of those, because listeners will want to know. Hang on.
I can actually make a big list of everything I brought home if people are really, really nosy. So, Lobster by Guillaume Le Casble looks just amazing. A woman eats a lobster on the Titanic and his tank mate watches and falls in love with her, and then they have a deep and sensual, and from what I can tell, quite out there affair as the Titanic sinks. That sounds fantastic. I'm really excited about that one. Who does not love lobster sex? The thing that worries me, and this might be an odd segue, is years ago when I met the writer James Bradley for the first time, he looked at me long and hard and said, I think you'd really enjoy this novella about a woman who has sex with a bear. And it just worries me that then booksellers in England looked at me and said, I think you'd really enjoy this book about a woman who has sex with a lobster. I'm just not sure what vibe I give out in the world. But you know what? They're all right. I have enjoyed them.
Well, from the spiky carapace to the soft furriness of the bear.
Yes.
Okay.
All the eulogies for the chickens. So,
the eulogies for the chickens. What's that one called?
It's called Fowl Eulogies, Fowl with a W, and it's by Lucci Rico. And it's a vegetarian who goes home to the family chicken farm, and it's written with all of these beautiful eulogies for the chickens all the way through it, which sounds just wonderful. Would you like me to read a chicken eulogy?
Oh, give us one chicken eulogy before I get at least two more books.
Harold was the incarnation of mediocrity. One foot was good, the other hooked in an unsatisfying fashion. To say he had a limp would have been excessive. His spurs were too large, his feathers too sparse. That did not keep Harold from being appreciated by his companions, who were no less mediocre than he. There are all these gorgeous chicken eulogies. The novel in verse I'm really excited about. It's by Robin Robertson. It's called The Long Take. I'd never heard of it. It's about a D-Day veteran with PTSD who goes to New York to escape
just everything, every noise, everything he has seen, everything he can't unsee, everyone he has loved who he can no longer love with all of himself. And he goes to New York and then to Los Angeles in the 1950s and finds in his own way that all of those things that he has seen and can't unsee are also in these places. And it's written in verse and it's just extraordinary. I was talking to a bookseller in London who sort of said, oh, can I please press this into your hands? And he actually keeps a kind of stock of it just to give to the right reader. So that looks really amazing.
Did they recommend anything that was sort of more mainstream, for want of a better word, popular fiction?
Yeah. So two, I've got one called The Delusions by Jenny Fagan, who wrote a really great book about witchcraft a couple of years ago. It is set in the HR department of Purgatory. It sounds fantastic.
There is something about Purgatory and afterlives meeting offices. Feels like we've read a few of those in the last few years,
yes,
so that's pretty interesting.
There's just been a film out with the same premise, but this one is great. It's called Pagans by James Alistair Henry, and it's about a 21st century London in a Britain that never became an empire. So the grand colonising power never accumulated, and so instead you have this sort of uneasy alliance of tribes. So instead, the great powers come from China, they come from Africa, and then you have basically a detective story within this counter-historical Britain. So it's about a Celtic diplomat who gets killed and then the cops who are sent from disparate tribes to unpick it, and it's fantastic, it's really good. So that one was also recommended to me. So I have everything from lobsters to counter histories to heaven and hell, and a beautiful one which I haven't had a chance to dig into yet, which has a lovely title, Shine On, Bright and Dangerous Object.
Oh, what a beautiful name.
Beautiful name by Laurie Colwin, which is a sort of, I've been told it's a sort of rom-com in the vein of Nora Ephron's Heartburn, but a little more caustically British. And it's one of those gems that was sort of foisted on me like, oh, take this as you go. It's really, really lovely. So it's from the 70s. It's from 1975, but it's just been reissued.
Well, they all sound wonderful. And just to reassure listeners, we are going to put those recommendations online. Just search for The Bookshelf and you'll find what they call the show notes, because we're terribly hip here now. The show notes from our podcast and broadcast will have all of those things listed.
AKA my luggage.
Very briefly, BJ, I know that part of your trip was a literary pilgrimage. Where did you go and why?
I went to Lyme Regis, which is on the Jurassic Coast, which is a seaside town that book lovers will either know from Persuasion or from John Fowles, the French Lieutenant's Woman. I went for John Fowles' reasons, because the very first book that I was given by my boyfriend, now husband, was The Collector by John Fowles. And it was the very first book anyone had ever given me that felt like a recommendation for me, as opposed to a recommendation from them. You know the difference, like someone who hands you a book and says, oh, I think you should read this because I love it, as opposed to someone who hands you a book and says, I think you would love this. And when I was 16, a boy at university handed me The Collector, and reader, I married him. So I went to Lyme Regis, where John Fowles lived and wrote, and I saw his house and his turret. He used to write in a turret. Who doesn't want to write a turret? I think we should all have a turret. And then I went fossil hunting on the Jurassic Coast with my mum, and we found pyrite ammonites and devil's toenails and witch's fingers and all other wonderful things on the beach.
Because the other thing about Lyme Regis, of course, is that that's where the 19th century fossil collector Mary Anning was from, which is where the she sells seashells by the seashore
comes
from. Oh,
nice. Well done. You did so well.
And also Tracy Chevalier's Remarkable Creatures is a historical novel that takes us into the life of Mary Anning. And I'd recommend that one as well. BJ Silcox, thanks so much for sharing your reading passions with us.
Oh, it's just been the best month, and it's so lovely to top it all off by being here with my big stack of candy.
BJ Silcox is a critic and essayist and a regular reviewer here on The Bookshelf. And as you heard, both BJ and Tony Birch had plenty of book recommendations for you. But you know what? I'd like to give you another one as well, another book that I've read in the last week. and that is Sally O'Reilly's Hagtale. Now, this is a book that explores a number of things all at once. There's a wolf girl living in a wild forest, and she's rescued by a trio of women. And then in a parallel story, we have a scholar monk who's searching for a lost library and for traces of history. So that is sort of dark and mysterious all on its own, because you're in these deep, dark forests in Britain that have a sort of fairy tale element to them, not to mention that you're coming face to face with creatures, with wolves, which I guess harks back to one of the stories that Tony Birch and I were talking about in Inga Simpson's collection of short stories, because there's a wolf looking back at us in that one as well. But the trio of women who come across this girl living in the woods, living as part of a pack of wolves, they're not just any women, they are the witches from Macbeth. Remember Double, Double, Toil and Trouble, Fire Burn and Cauldron Bubble? It's those three who emerge and look after this girl, but something is owed to them for the care that they give her. So this girl becomes Lady Macbeth in 11th century Scotland. So that's part of this novel. This book is indeed subtitled A Macbeth Origin Story. And the monk, well, he's surrounded by both Highlands and politics, and his story is set 3 centuries later. So there's a whole spiritual and uncanny edge to this novel. It's dark, it's dangerous, it's wild. And I guess it's part of that genre of novels that we keep encountering here on the bookshelf, which is retelling and reinterpreting of folk tales. And I guess that's been done if we go back all the way to Angela Carter. But Greek mythology keeps on being told in contemporary fiction again and again. Classics from Shakespeare to Austen take on a new perspective. And look, I'll confess that I started to think, do I really need another fairy tale retold? Do I really need another retelling of Greek mythology? But this one did win me over, because there's something fresh about it, and also the writing is quite beautiful. It leans into the uncanny. It takes us into these lives with a real darkness to the story that I found, well, both fresh and sort of entered into the politics of these stories in some way that made you think about the bodies and what was at stake with history being retold. So this one is pretty good, I'd have to say. It's Sally O'Reilly's Hagtale, and it's published by Scribe. If you're still not sure what to read next, I love a shortlist as a way to discover works that I've missed. So congratulations to the shortlisted writers of the New South Wales Literary Awards, which have just been announced this week, across fiction, non-fiction, poetry, script writing and more. Winners will be announced on the 18th of May for that one. There are so many, many books out there, and we'll bring you even more next time. Cassie McCullough will be back, and here on the bookshelf we're tackling books in translation from France and Bulgaria, as well as Australian writer Amanda Laurie's latest, it's called Capture, and Deepa Annapara's story of Tibet, The Last of Earth. I'm Kate Evans. Join us in front of our shared bookshelf next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.